We're short one of the tools of the trade this morning, which is the gavel, so you get to listen to me call you all in.
It's very straight. I can tell you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Davis.
I have started meetings in the past with this keychain. You like this. Whoops.
How much for the ring of keys? I have no idea what they're for. Minimum bid, $10,000.
Do you even know what you just did? Especially you know you have a new Suburban.
All the tricks.
And those of you who know David's, he's got more money than anybody, so this should bring a nice price.
Can you spend the interest?
Well, thank you, everyone, for being here this morning. We have a couple of housekeeping details to work on this morning, and then we're going to spend the majority of our time hearing a presentation from the Department of Commerce. We have some directors and deputy commissioners and the commissioner herself, Grace Arnold, will be here to visit with us about priorities. I want to compliment the group yesterday. You had very, very good, insightful questions for OCM, and I'm hoping that we have the same today. I love the civility. I love the fact that people are asking good questions, and the departments liked it, and again, keeping that going today is going to be helpful in our work that is ahead of us. One of the things that I would also like to do is we have someone who has joined us today who wasn't here yesterday, and we'll go ahead and have him introduce himself and tell us a little bit about his involvement in the Commerce Committee and the like. He's no stranger.
Eric Anderson, DFL Research. Been with the committee since 2019, and I don't know, in the past we'd always say our favorite restaurant, so Simply Pho, Apple Valley.
Thank you and welcome. The next order of business is the approval of the minutes from yesterday's meeting. And Representative Hewitt, have you had a chance to review those minutes, sir?
Mr. Chair, I have, and so moved.
Representative Hewitt moves the minutes from the Commerce meeting, the first one of the session, first one of the biennium of the March 11th minutes. Any corrections? And because we're under Mason's rules, we do not need seconds, so it has been moved. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion prevails, and the minutes are adopted. Our major piece of business before the commission and committee today is the conversation on the governor's proposal being brought to us for budget and policy by the Department of Commerce, which is within the jurisdiction and purview of the committee. Joining us today, we do have a couple folks from the department. I'm going to defer to the commissioner, and we have some packets that should have been delivered to everyone at this point that will be a part of the PowerPoint presentation that you have, and they're also posted online for those who may be viewing from afar here. With that, in those proceedings, if you are interested in asking questions or following up on items, just catch my attention or one of the staff folks up here, and then we'll get you on the list, and we will proceed accordingly. And without any further ado, I'm going to introduce the Minnesota Commissioner of Commerce, Grace Arnold. Commissioner, welcome to the committee.
Thank you so much, Chair O'Driscoll. So I have the slides that I'm going to use.
Commissioner, if you could just pull that microphone just a little closer.
This is always my problem. Okay.
Thank
Please
you.
Please remind me if I get distracted. All right. So good morning, Chair O'Driscoll and members. For the record, I'm Grace Arnold. I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Commerce. I have here with me Sam Smith, who's our Director of Government Affairs, and I'll introduce the rest of my team who is sitting over there a little bit later in the presentation. So thank you for inviting me to come to the committee to present on our department and also our department budget proposals for this year. I'm going to provide you with an overview of the department to introduce to you how we serve Minnesotans and where you might see commerce at work. Give you a hint, it's a lot of places. And then I'll present our proposals for budget and policy. So our mission and strategic priorities, I think it's helpful to start with those. So we, for over 150 years, have, as the department and then many predecessor agencies, protected and assisted consumers in the marketplace. We oversee or regulate over 40 industry areas. The type of oversight or regulation depends on the industry area. But in general, we're there to protect consumers and to ensure that we have a strong, competitive, and fair marketplace. And then we work to engage people and communities across the state to make sure that we're doing well. We carry out our mission through five strategic priorities, which you can see here. We protect the public interest. We serve as a trusted resource. We work to reduce economic barriers and build resilience in the face of a changing climate. And then we work to foster a strong, competitive, and fair marketplace in Minnesota. The exact ways that each unit does this are a little bit different, but everyone is doing this every day. So we like to say that we're with you every day, and I've started to joke that that's like not in a creepy way. We're there to support you. And so, you know, if you're filling up on gas, there's a Commerce Department sticker. You can be assured that your gallon of gas is a gallon of gas. If you're purchasing a home, we oversee mortgage lending in the state. We also oversee real estate licenses, and so if you have an issue with that process, we're there to help. If you're taking steps to reduce your energy use, this is not much we'll get into in this committee, but in the Energy Committee, we do a lot of work in helping people to save money on their energy bills. Or if you're rebuilding after a disaster, you may be working with your bank, you may be working with your insurance company. All of those are industries that we oversee. And then we do a lot of other things. So these are kind of the variety of services that we oversee. So we have financial institutions. I'll talk a little bit more about each of these. Insurance, enforcement, licensing, energy resources, and then we have other areas like unclaimed property. So I'll focus today on this committee's purview, which so I won't cover our Division of Energy Resources or telecommunications. Both of those are outside of the purview. So our leadership team is great. They're all really experienced and really dedicated public servants. So I have a few of them here, and I will embarrass them by asking them to wave when I announce them, and not all of them will be comfortable with that. So Tim Janke is our deputy commissioner and COO. So he makes the magic work of all of our budget, but also oversees unclaimed property, licensing, and the Petro Fund. And weights and measures. Amanda Kelting is our director over our securities division. You'll hear we have a proposal for that. Haley Colkind is our assistant commissioner and is assistant commissioner chief of staff. Jackie Olson is our assistant commissioner over enforcement. We also have Trayvon Hood there. He's on our government affairs and external affairs team. So in addition to the folks I just introduced, we have Pete Wyckoff and Sydney Lieb and Lissa Polish oversee our energy team. Mike Crow oversees our financial institutions, so that's banks, credit unions, and non-depositories, so that's a whole bucket of things. Let me give Sam a moment to get his teams up. I was confirmed by the Senate in 2023, and then our entire staff is about 460 people. We have a statewide reach. So this is a map of Minnesota's state chartered banks. So you can see that they are, you know, everywhere from Thief River Falls all the way down. So there are state chartered banks across the state. We have 187 state chartered banks with $65 billion in assets and about $55 billion in deposits. And then we have 60 state chartered credit unions with over $32 billion in assets. Last year, we issued a new charter. So in my time, we've issued one new charter for a new bank, which is a new trend. There had been a kind of decreasing number for a while. And a new charter for a credit union, which is the first state chartered credit union in 23 years. And it's the first Black-led credit union in Minnesota. So it's been operating online and is prepared to open its doors this spring. I just saw that they had a few job postings, so they're really getting going, which is really great. Also within our financial institutions division, we have securities and investments. So through that unit, we register, examine, and regulate 447 investment advisors that manage $11 billion of Minnesotans' assets in over 51,000 accounts. There are about five FTEs in Commerce who are responsible for oversight of that $11 billion. So we'll come back to that later because we have a problem in that area. We oversee almost 10,000 investment advisors in Minnesota, and we have other securities entities and products. So like we license franchises. So if you want to buy a franchise, you'll go through our process. The next area of our financial institutions division that I'd like to talk about is our non-depository financial institutions. So these are non-banks. Unlike traditional banks, these non-bank entities don't hold deposits, but they do manage a lot of money. So these include money transmitters like PayPal, payday lenders, debt servicers, and mortgage servicers. This is just kind of an example of how our financial services have changed over time. In past years, most mortgages would have been written by a bank or credit union. Now Rocket Mortgage, which falls under this type of license, is the largest, services the majority of mortgages in the state. So this is a really important area and increasingly as the financial structure changes. So then next I'll move to our insurance division. We regulate insurance carriers for auto, health, homeowners, as well as life, long-term care, and workers' comp. There are a handful of other very niche lines that we oversee as well. On health insurance, I just want to note, because this can get confusing sometimes, I think, we oversee one part of the overall coverage picture within within the state. So we oversee individual, small group, and fully insured plans. And then we also do like dental, Medicare supplemental, and then there are some employer arrangements called MIWAs that we oversee as well. The federal government regulates self-insured health plans, which is most large employers. So if you work at Target, we don't oversee your coverage. And it regulates Medicare, including Medicare Advantage. The Department of Health oversees HMOs, which offer a subset of the coverage on the individual small group. And then DHS oversees Medicaid. For insurers, we have oversight that involves a few things. So we examine, analyze, and license carriers to ensure financial safety and claims paying ability for each insurer. I think the first thing I learned from my team when I came in was that the first consumer protection we have is that the company exists so that they can be in the market and pay claims. And so that's sort of the bedrock on the rest of the work. We also review forms and rate filings to ensure the product offerings are fair and reasonable. And the type of review we do depends on the type of product. So all health insurance rates are pre-approved by us before they go into the market. In homeowners and auto, they operate by a system called file and use. So the carriers file the rates and then use them, and then we go back and kind of flag things that look either like not in compliance with law, rates that seem out of line with others, or rates that seem a little too high. So to ensure consistency with our review standards across states, we go through an accreditation process with the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. So that involves making sure that our systems and processes align with kind of national standards so that when we examine a company here, all the other states in the country can rely on the fact that that's a financially sound company. We were last accredited in 2022. We do have a policy bill that's tied to that accreditation this year, so I'll get to that in a little bit. We also monitor markets and make policy recommendations, particularly in the focused on the health and stability of the market. We do a variety of other things in the insurance division. We collaborate with other state agencies in the health space. We're a member of the health subcabinet and collaborate with health, labor, DHS, MNsure, and CGIP on that work. We also collaborate with stakeholders to identify new health policy solutions, and we hold and work on the state's 1332 waiver, which is our waiver to operate our reinsurance a little bit later. We also have oversight over pharmacy benefit managers and providers of last resort. So one of the great things about working in the department is that we are national leaders on a number of things, and I'll just highlight a few, particularly in our insurance division. So we have been leaders in setting standards to reflect changing business practices, such as how to account for private equity funds when reviewing life insurance companies. We developed and passed a model law for long-term care insurance, which has been particularly important for middle-income Minnesotans. And then we were the first state in the Midwest to establish a pre-disaster mitigation program called our Strengthen Minnesota Homes program. We followed a lot of the southern states who have been hit by hurricanes and have had to do some incentives to make sure that people can harden their homes so that they aren't continuing these huge losses. Our enforcement division enforces kind of across the board, so they have divisions that kind of align with each of the other divisions that we have, so insurance and financial institutions. They work to protect and educate consumers, ensure marketplace fairness, and prevent all unlawful activities in the areas we regulate. We also do a lot of question answering. We get a lot of questions in, particularly after a big storm. We have a big increase in insurance questions and complaints. We initiate investigations in a number of areas. So insurance, it's across all of our lines of regulation. In a multi-industry area, they kind of get the grab bag of all the other enforcement areas. So that's real estate, mortgage lending is sort of, they have a lot of consumer financial areas under their responsibility. We also can look at property appraisal and mortgage companies, real estate brokers and companies. And then we investigate securities and franchise individuals and professionals and companies to make sure that they're complying with Minnesota law. So the work that that team has done over the last year, we've taken in over 15,000 calls, opened over 9,000 civil investigations, helped to recover $23 million on behalf of consumers, and assessed over $2 million in civil penalties. And I would just note, we'll talk about this as needed, we have, until last week, the Commerce Fraud Bureau was located within the Commerce Department. That's been combined with the Financial Crimes Unit within the BCA and is now part of a larger Fraud and Financial Crimes Unit. And we can talk about that as much as you all would like. So this is kind of a summary of the functions that our Enforcement Division does. I'd like to call out a couple things. Our Mental Health Parity Office and our Student Loan Advocate are new. Those are positions that we've added in response to complicated and needed specific areas where we get a lot of consumer inquiries. So the mental health space, as you can, I'm sure folks have come to talk to you all about that. And then student loans have been, we just get a lot of questions, and so this has helped to kind of triage those and also get an understanding of kind of where our enforcement powers lie within the within those areas. So senior fraud is one that I want to call out in particular. If you have a senior in your life or a vulnerable adult, you know that they are big targets. Everyone is probably getting targets to, you know, scams and things. But particularly older and vulnerable adults are targeted. So we've gone through a number of iterations of a law to protect Minnesota seniors and vulnerable adults from scammers and others. In 2018 and then again in 2020, we bolstered the protections. So that means that banks, investment advisors, and other financial professionals can put holds on suspected fraud, so they don't have to wait for an investigation. We can kind of go in and quickly stop, because often once the money's gone, it's really hard to get back. And then we've added staff over the last year, and that's been really helpful in making sure that we can do a lot more outreach and education. They're all over the state. They've opened over 1,000 cases in 2024 and put on hold $7.7 million to prevent fraud and financial exploitation. So I'll talk a little bit more about this. So trusted, these can be really complicated to investigate because often they involve trusted family or friends. And so the way to kind of go through that investigation and gain trust is really difficult. There also are phone scams. So someone calls and impersonates the IRS, a bank or a utility. There are romance scams. And then text and email scams, such as claiming the scam target won the lottery, or another common one is like, hey, I misplaced your number, or are we still meeting Tuesday, and it's not a real person, and then they get you into this long text conversation, and all of a sudden you're transferring money to buy Bitcoin that's not real. It seems far-fetched, but it happens a lot. So licensing is one of the areas that commerce that has statewide reach. We administer licenses to over 300,000 professionals and businesses. That includes insurance agents and adjusters, real estate agents and brokers, property appraisers, debt collectors, and other businesses. This is one of my favorite fun facts about the department. We license athletic agents. So if any of you are looking to get into that business, you would need to come and get a license from us. We don't have very many of those. And I'll just note that that list is sort of our basic licensing. We also hold licenses within our financial institutions division that are part of our state chartered system. Next, I'll talk about unclaimed property. I'll say at least once when I've done this presentation in my time here, someone has found unclaimed property during the committee hearing. So if you all want to look, you are welcome to. Unclaimed property is money that's legally owed to the owner or heir, and it's eventually returned to the state. In 2024, we returned almost $75 million to Minnesotans who have submitted claims. So I would encourage you all to look up. Sometimes we get questions about why would you have unclaimed property? I'll give my own personal example. I have, which I have not claimed yet because I haven't done the paperwork, $75 of unclaimed property from when I had my first child because the bills sorted out and then I moved and then they couldn't find me. And so now the DC government has, the DC unclaimed property has my $75, which I will get back eventually. But those are the kinds of things. Sometimes they're larger, but often it's return checks, it's things like that. We took in about $158 million from businesses and organizations. And so these could be like forgotten bank accounts. Sometimes we get safety deposit boxes, uncashed checks or wages. I'll move on to the Petro Fund. So,
interrupt for just a second. I want to go back to the unclaimed properties. Let us help you and your department do your job.
Yes.
On here, but I'll start by saying, please claim your $75 because the department doesn't want to carry that on the books any longer than they need to. And I want to underscore this. And when I say let us help you with that, if you could send out that information to the members on the committee or at least to the staff, and then we can disseminate that to both caucuses. To be honest with you folks, we all send out updates to our constituents, and if you put this in there and say the state of Minnesota may owe you money, everybody's eyes are going to go to that. And if we put the link on there of how to claim that, that will actually help them clean out their records. And we try to do that about once a year, or at least once a biennium on that. And again, as the commissioner indicated, it's money that is owed to you because of an abandoned account that you had, and they can't keep the money at the institution or at the vendor, and so they turn it over to the state, and the state tries to find the rightful owner of that. And so the state may have money for you and or your constituents, and so it's kind of a nice consumer and constituent services type of thing to be able to do. So let us help you by getting that, and we'll make sure it gets to our respective caucuses.
Excellent, absolutely.
And I know what's going to happen is going to be a spike in business, and you're going to be back asking for FTEs, but at least
thank you for helping me to get there.
Thank you, Madam Commissioner.
We really do appreciate when there can be outreach. So we have little blurbs that you can put in too. So we've been trying to get more placement of, a little bit of like, hey, do you know? And that's really helpful. We can also do some specific pulls of data if you're interested in kind of having information about your district. We can say, oh, there's this much or things like that. All right, Petro Fund. So the Petro Fund is it helps to remediate leaks from petroleum, gas, or gas storage tanks that are one of the nation's leading causes for groundwater pollution. So we manage the Petro Fund, which provides reimbursement to address leaking tanks. Since 1987, we have addressed almost 14,000 leak sites with about $476 million in reimbursements. We've removed 675 abandoned underground tanks from 446 properties. Weights and Measures is our oldest consumer protection. So it was established in 1885 and tests the accuracy of commercial products sold by weight and volume. So as I mentioned earlier, you'll see our stickers on gas pumps and grocery scales. We do a lot more than that. We have a rail car. We can have like little quarter gram weights. So if you are ever interested in a tour, we can do that. It's fun for if you have like a heart of, I don't want to say nerdiness, but if you like precision, this is an excellent place for you to see. that is a really great service that we provide. So if you'd like to find out more about commerce, we can also, this is maybe another thing that you could put in your newsletters. You can file a complaint or an external appeal for a health insurance claim denial. You can look up licenses or report senior fraud on and all these things in addition to unclaimed property. So I would encourage you all, if you have people who are or constituents who are reaching out with questions. Our website is a good place to start, but we can also, you know, if there's anything in particular you're hearing about, we can give you a little bit of information about where to help people. So if you, after a disaster, we can send like, oh, here, go to file a complaint if you're having trouble with your insurance. And we appreciate any support that we can.
Commissioner, before we go on to part two, which is the budget, yeah. I want to see if there's any questions that folks have on the first part of your presentation. Yeah. And I also want to put some, maybe some footnotes on here. Two areas that were discussed in here by the commissioner, we're going to have separate meetings on this. Tomorrow is the proposed move through the executive order, and it's not even really proposed. It's underway right now. And I know that members have concerns about that move, and it's bipartisan. So I've worked with the commissioner and the superintendent of the BCA to be here to be able to explain to us and allow us to interact with them tomorrow. So questions of that nature, we have an entire hearing, an entire meeting dedicated to that. So if we can stay away from those kinds of questions today and just work on those tomorrow, that would be great. And the second part is the reinsurance discussion that will be coming up in the budget portion. We're also going to, sooner rather than later, we're still kind of working out the details for next week's committee and stuff. But we will most likely be looking for another bringing folks back and talking about reinsurance. How does it work? What the options are, and how we've done it, and some proposals that are out there. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for being here, Commissioner. This isn't necessarily for today, but I need to get in touch with someone in your department that has to do with health insurance. There's a product out there that's out there for years, and Minnesota has really dropped the ball on this one. It's called short-term major medical. It's used very effectively if someone switches jobs and they're not on their new plan for 90 days, they can buy a 90-day policy. It's very, very important to people's portfolios when they're going through changes like that. And I think we either have one or zero companies that are allowed to write that. The department needs to help some of these insurance companies. There's companies applying to get in. We need this for Minnesotans. It's very, very important. So if you could send someone in my direction from the health insurance area, that would be greatly appreciated. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Arnold.
Hey, Chair O'Driscoll and Representative Davids, thanks for the question. So we have companies that have made business decisions not to write the profit. We have or write that line of business. We haven't made anything. We haven't done anything to prevent anyone from coming into the market. So but happy to have a longer conversation about that.
Representative Davids, follow-up.
Thank you, Commissioner, and thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's not what I'm hearing. What I'm hearing is the department is a buzzsaw to try and get these things approved. I can give you many, many examples of companies that have tried. Some have pulled out because of the regulation from the department. So we need to get some of this sorted out. We need, you know, a robust short-term major medical arena in Minnesota. We don't have that right now. And then the companies that I've talked to have just shaken their head and said, this department, we just can't work with them. And so I want to change that so the department can work with these companies so they can get these short-term major medical policies on the books in Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Madam Commissioner, did you want to respond to that?
No.
Okay. You know, to Representative Davids' point, if there's an impediment in legislation and the statute that needs to be addressed, we're certainly willing to address that to be able to give Minnesotans the products that they need for their insurance needs and work with the department on that.
Okay, I appreciate that.
Representative Herr has the next question, followed by Representative Faulkner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, I just wanted to say one, that the Senior Financial Fraud Protection is actually working. My mom told me a week ago that she got a call from her bank. They thought there was fraud in her activity, and so she was, and there was. And so I just want to say kudos to the team for doing a good job with that. The other thing is for the committee is you should definitely go look at your unclaimed property, because I was one of those people during a call with her. I was like, I have $250 sitting somewhere. I had no idea. Then I went back to check every state that I've lived in, and I have money left in every state. So you should definitely do that. But I do have a really quick question, Commissioner. On your financial institution division, it says here there are 447 investment advisors, but then it says almost 10,000 local investment advisor representatives. What's the difference between the investment advisors and the investment advisor representatives?
Thank you,
Madam
for the,
Commissioner.
Chair O'Driscoll and Representative Herr, thanks for the question. So I'll make sure that I'm answering this correctly, and Amanda can jump up if I'm not. So investment advisors are like so the place where we have our retirement savings, there are like, I think, 15 people who work there under one company. And so that's, I think, the distinction that you get is some are licensed as investment advisor representatives, like the humans that you're talking to,
sure.
And then investment advisors are the companies.
Representative, her follow-up.
And maybe this is not as much for commissioners, maybe for, I guess, because this is a personal interest of mine, having worked in the finance and investments for 15 years. But I thought it was really interesting to see that if you look at our population of 5.7 million people and there's 51,000 accounts, that's less than 1% of our population with accounts, and they own $11 billion of Minnesota's money in these investment accounts. And so I just thought that was very interesting that less than 1% of people own that much in assets. But anyways, just a comment maybe for us to sort of as a team and people to think about what that means of who owns all the wealth in our state. Anyways, that's all I have, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Arnold?
No response to that.
Okay. My error, Representative Faulkner, was trying to get my attention to let me know that it was Representative Cha that has the next question, followed by Representative Finke. Representative Cha. Representative,
thank you, Chair.
You are on the list as well.
My question is in regards to, addressing, social media fraud and text fraud and email fraud in second English learning communities. Can you tell me about how the department's addressing that?
Commissioner?
Chair O'Driscoll and Representative Cha, thanks for the question. So we have authorities that are fairly specific to financial transactions. So if you are a senior who may have fraud, the authority lives at the financial institution, so your bank or credit union. So we don't have authorities. DPS may have some, and the BCA, to go after kind of the overall criminal scheme that can exist around the fraud. Ours is located, like the authority sits with the financial institution and then with us working with the financial institution.
Representative Cha, follow-up?
No, thank you.
You're welcome. Representative Finke, followed by Representative Hewitt. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you so much for being here. This is my first time on the committee. I'm genuinely asking this question, not trying to be a troublemaker, but I would like to understand how your enforcement is connected to our federal government's enforcement, because we're seeing, for example, the Consumer Protection Finance Bureau is going to be gutted. Basically, all of our data at the entire U.S. Treasury has been compromised. The judiciary is being compromised. Winning judgments on behalf of consumers is going to get more difficult. And it feels like the new administration's effort is to weaken consumer protections at every single level in order to protect financial institutions, banking institutions, and people will have a harder time at the federal level being able to protect their consumer interests, financial interests, and just have access to a fair economic future. And it's just impossible for me to assume that's not going to affect your ability to do that in the state of Minnesota. So can you just tell me a little bit about how those things interact?
Yep.
Commissioner Arnold.
Chair O'Driscoll and Representative Finke, thanks for the question. So we're closely monitoring what's going on at the federal level. So it's a little different by area. So in our financial institutions area, there is, in the bank side, there's a state and federal system, and we work together with state and federal, but there's sort of a charter, so you can be a federally chartered or a state chartered. Most of the banks have opted to be a state chartered bank, which is great. Like, I think that says a lot about the work that we do and the service we provide as regulators, but also it means that the enforcement tools are at the state level for those institutions. In credit unions, if you are at a federally chartered credit union, I think that's likely where, depending on what happens with the CFPB, if you have a complaint, we currently send it on to the CFPB. I don't know how much authority there will be. We don't have authority over the federal credit unions. So those are the places that we're trying to understand what some of those changes might mean. In the health insurance space, I think I mentioned, so the large employers, so that's like if you work at Target or Best Buy, the federal government does enforcement on not necessarily rates, because they're sort of assuming that it's a large purchaser that's purchasing with a savvy purchaser, and the company is taking on the financial risk. But things like mental health parity is a big one that is enforced at the federal level. And so for those large employers, any changes in the posture that the federal government would take would happen likely in those kinds of spaces. And then in our other spaces, it's much more sort of state-based, but certainly we have been awarded over almost $1 billion in federal funds for state energy programs. A lot of that's for like transmission lines. It's like basic infrastructure upgrades. So we're certainly watching really closely. I think we'll have to see. I think one of the things that has been, I guess, a lesson from the last few weeks is that there's a lot of change pretty quickly. And so as we try to understand where the enforcement posture, you know, ultimately lands, then we're happy to provide any updates. But I can't sit here and say these are the exact five things that are going to happen because it's not quite clear right now. But generally, that's how it works. So there's kind of in health insurance and the financial institutions in particular, there are a mixed bag of enforcement. And then in our other areas, it gets sort of more and more state. Like we rely on state law more.
Representative Finke, follow up.
Yes, thank you, Chair. I appreciate that. And I know that a lot of one thing I do know about the regulatory world is that certainty is valued, and this is probably the most uncertain time we've had in a very, very long time. So if your agency is starting to see gaps that are being left open, and we could find ways to reinforce protections for Minnesota's consumers, I would hope that you would let us know so that we can make sure we are filling those gaps and not leaving people unaware of what their options are. Thank you.
Commissioner.
Chair Jessica, Representative Finke, thanks for the question. I think we'll absolutely, be able to have conversations about what we see. I think that the one thing that I would just point out to this group is that there are legal sort of questions, or, you know, we're watching what happens on the legal side. One thing that we have heard is that if there are big staffing reductions, that's going to reduce service from the federal side for the kinds of things, particularly when we're doing joint examinations. So, you know, they're not as responsive on the federal side. We can be more responsive on the state side, but if there aren't enough people to do the examinations that are required by law, there are some, like, practical challenges as well. And we're happy to talk through those should they arise. We'll have to see.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Finke. Commissioner, I want to just underscore something in the conversation here, and that is there are what you were talking about in the bank world and in the credit union world. There are federally chartered and there are state chartered. I would like you to background for the committee what you've seen over the last number of years, that and I'll kind of guide you where I'm going. We've seen a lot of federally chartered credit unions and banks give up their federal charter and move back to Minnesota supervision, so there isn't as much federal influence on that. Perhaps you want to talk about that for the committee's benefit.
Yeah, Chair Driscoll, thank you for leading me into a great story. So we have, particularly in the bank space, there's banks can choose to be federally regulated or state regulated. We see more than half of, or I think 75%, I'll have to get the exact number, of banks in the state are choosing to be federal or choosing to be state regulated. That's for a lot of reasons. One is that we provide good service as a regulator, so that doesn't mean that we don't let things go, but it does mean that we're timely, it means that we're communicative, and it means that we have a process that's easy to work with within the regulatory space where, you know, we do regulate. And so if someone is, you know, if a bank looks like it's not financially sound, then we will, you know, take actions, and we have a series of actions that are laid out in law. I think that's it's a testament to the team and the way that the team works and the way that the team approaches their job in making sure that we are responsive and collaborative with people on process and then clear about the regulatory authority.
And then the last thing I want to just mention is the McCarran-Ferguson Act of 1945 gave states the individual rights to regulate insurance and products within their own boundaries. And as a result of that, many of the insurance products that we have available are state regulated. obviously Medicare is federal, so we don't have oversight there. And as the commissioner was talking about large companies that are self-insured, those are governed under the 1974 ERISA laws. And so oftentimes because they transcend more than one state to try to provide uniformity of benefits, that's where the federal government comes in on an interstate commerce-related activity, for the lack of a longer answer here this morning. So just wanted to, for the committee's benefit on that. I have Representative Hewitt, and then we'll go to Representative Elkins, and then Representative Ryer. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just going to ask the one question and then follow up on it. But I just want to understand, Commerce regulates title companies. Do they regulate, and you can correct me on the follow-up if I'm wrong, homeowner associations, primarily in this space of property management for homeowners, not for commercial, but for homeowners. Are these in the purview of the Commerce Department?
Chair O'Driscoll, Representative Hewitt, no. No, but we get a lot of complaints.
I'm sorry?
No, we do not. But we hear about that a lot.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Hewitt.
So title companies, no?
Oh, sorry. Yes to title companies, no to homeowners.
Okay, but HOAs or property management are not?
Correct.
Okay, and so my concern is that I have a problem in my area that I've been trying to deal with for now 2 years, and it involves all of these services, and when the homeowners talk to the Commerce Department, they get the same thing I would get, is we cannot comment on an active investigation if it's live or if it's not. These are seniors, and they have a lot of time on their hands. That's great. I mean, they're staying on top of it. But it would be neat to have a vehicle that maybe not just give them that statement that we can't comment, because it's the same story you're going to give to me. Not story, but it's the same facts you got to give to me. And so is there any way we can think outside the box that we can just show that it's either active or not active, and that they kind of know, because it'll put them at ease, it'll also put me at ease. So that's my self-interest more than anything, but this is an area that I've been dealing with for 3 years, and I'm concerned about it. The HOAs, I think we do need to look at that as not only the HOAs, but also we're seeing like monies that have been taken into trust in these HOAs that are meant for property management, and they're walking out the door with it, and this is homeowners, it isn't commercial. So I think that we have to maybe hopefully look at that in this committee, but maybe it'll end up in your preview. But you can tell I'm a little frustrated, so thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hewitt, before I ask the commissioner to comment on that, have you met Representative Elkins? He's working on that very same issue right now.
No, who is he? No.
Gentleman across the table. If I might, the gentleman that's on the far end also was working on this issue last year, where it was brought to the committee from various members and members of the public, that this is a question and an issue. So it's something that's kind of in the pipeline with this committee, but we certainly don't have any definitive answers on that at this point. But I'm going to go to the commissioner for final follow-up on that. And then I have Representative Elkins and Ryer. Is there anyone else who would like to talk before we move into the final hour, which will be the budget proposals? Okay, Representative Elkins, and then Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So one of the areas that I'm still not clear on the boundaries for is Medicare and Medicaid insurance. So we have the status of being a so-called waiver state, I think, for both programs. So Medicaid, the design of Medicaid plans, we clearly have a great deal of latitude over. But I'm under the impression, but don't really quite know the boundaries of the degree to which we can regulate Medicare supplement plans and Medicare Advantage plans. And so I would really love to understand those boundaries better.
Chair O'Driscoll and Representative Elkins. So I can give you the short version, and if you have additional questions, then we can do the long version maybe separately. So Medicare Advantage is regulated by the federal government. That includes the benefits, it includes the pricing, it includes the marketing, which has been a real sore spot with insurance commissioners across the country, because we get complaints from consumers and we oversee agents and brokers, but we don't have a lot of oversight there. So that's Medicare Advantage. We do have in both cases, we are slightly different than most other states. the reasons for that are different in Medicare Advantage and Medicare Supplement. So that's where the long version is perhaps more helpful. We oversee the Medicare supplemental market. So we, you know, and that is doing the, all the same things. We look at benefits. We look at rates. We do have, so in most other states, there's a letter, there's kind of like a letter scheme that helps you understand generally what things are covered. We have a different letter scheme here than other states do. So we are different in that case. I don't know whether it's a waiver or not. We'll have to see. And waiver, I will say, means very different things if you're in Medicare versus in Medicaid versus in the private market. And so, but yes, happy to do a longer version if that's helpful. But the basic version is we oversee Medicare Supplemental. The federal government oversees Medicare Advantage. And in both cases, we have slightly different products that are offered here in Minnesota than other states. And there is a history behind all of that.
Okay. Well, if there's somebody who understands Representative that, history, that would be wonderful. Thank you. Yeah, I'm good.
And of course, as you, as Representative Hewitt was saying, you know, seniors have a lot of time on their hands, and being able to explain to them the difference between Medicare Advantage, federally regulated, yeah, versus the state regulated products that are the supplements that are sold. Nothing is easy.
And Chair O'Driscoll, if I can just put a plug in for the senior linkage line, because they do a really great job of helping consumers understand, we can talk about the regulatory side.
And with that, Representative Ryer has the final question in this segment. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. A question I expect to be hearing from constituents about concerns about their banking stability. Mm-hmm. So how would they know if they're state chartered or federally chartered? And what is the likelihood for someone who's a member, say, of have banks at Wells Fargo or U.S. Bank, one of the large national? Thank you.
Commissioner Arnold.
Chair O'Driscoll, Representative Ryer, thanks for the question. So I think the first thing to think about if you're thinking about kind of overall stability is that stability is – safety and soundness is sort of the one, number one thing about the banking system, and that – and all deposits under $250,000 or $200,000, I'm forgetting, are federally insured by the FDIC. So for consumers, there are a lot of protections. The larger banks, so Wells Fargo, U.S. Bank, are federally chartered. I think we could look up if they're – I don't know if we have a license lookup. I'll have to get back to you on that one about federally or state chartered. The overall system, I think, you know, for those large deposit institutions, they have a lot of people who rely on the fact that they exist, right? And so federal regulation is certainly helpful in assuming that, but there are also a lot of other pressures that keep the stability in the system.
Representative Ryer, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if someone is a banks at a particular location, you know, whether it's a standalone or part of a system, would they go to the bank's website? And if they wanted to know, if they wanted to break down that map, yeah, and say, is my bank on this list, how would they find that out?
Chair O'Driscoll, Representative Ryer, let us get back to you about the fastest way to do that. Yeah.
And thankfully, during the time that Representative Stevenson was chair and I was the lead, we didn't get the Friday afternoon calls. And the department knows, and so does Representative Stevenson, when I say the Friday afternoon calls, that's the call to advise the members of the legislature that have jurisdiction over banking and the commissioner that there's going to be insolvency and that the feds and or state is going to have to step in and do a merger of institutions to protect the consumer in those situations. So thankfully we have not had in the last 3 to 4 years the Friday afternoon call.
I have, Chair O'Driscoll, I have not yet had that pleasure. I hope to not have it in my time.
So I know in their office they have a sign that says, how many days without a Friday afternoon call? No, I'm just kidding. with that, I missed one of our members, Representative Binsberg, and if you would like to go ahead with your question, we do have a few minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, thank you for being here today. I just had a quick question in regards to credit unions and state chartered banks. And you said that there's been, in the last 23 years, there's been the first credit union charter. My question is, and then how about state chartered banks? Has there been any new state chartered banks? You know, 23 years, it seems like a long time
yep.
since there's been any new banks, and I'm just, could you get a little context about that?
Yeah, Chair O'Driscoll, and I'm sorry.
Representative
Van Binsbergen. So we've had one new state chartered bank. I think that was 22. But don't hold me to that. It's in the it was in my time, so it's been in the last 4.5 years. I want to say it was 22. So I think, and yes, we would love to see more financial institutions. The barrier tends to be with the sort of requirements for safety and soundness and the capital requirements. I sit on the legislative committee for the Conference of State Banking Supervisors, and there is a lot of conversation at the federal level about reducing some of the requirements on that would, you know, ideally allow for more, like it would lower barriers to entry in that space. It's one we're watching. That is one I think, you know, a lot of times the way I talk about our work is that we have a balance. So we want the businesses to thrive and we want consumers to be protected. Those aren't always in conflict with each other, but where they are, we're doing a balance across those. I think about it the same way here. You want to have financial institutions. I think it's good to have local financial institutions, and it's good to have business development in the state. You also want to make sure that those businesses will be around for the long run, and so it's a and that they are safe and sound for people to deposit their assets into. And so that's sort of where the balancing works. But it's certainly something that's a conversation at the federal level. That's where more of the barriers are. But we could, you know, we can continue that conversation, especially as we see what develops at the federal level.
Representative Van Binsbergen, a follow-up.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to reiterate, I think it's important. I mean, 23 years for a credit union, a new credit union, and then a new state chartered bank, it's been, you know, if you said there's been one, I don't know how far back it went to get that one. So I just encourage you to keep an eye on that. I think that's important. Thank you.
Commissioner Arnold?
Yeah, Chair O'Driscoll and Representative, it's definitely important. I think it took a while after the financial crisis, but that was a lot of closures during that time. And so I'm hoping, we'll see, that we may be on kind of in a restabilization that would allow for more of that. I think it's, I agree. I think we should have.
I would just also put this in the context of the number of financial institutions, whether they're federally chartered or state chartered. We have seen a number of them move from the federal charter to the state charter. Although they're an existing institution, they're chosen to be regulated by the state of Minnesota and filed for and moved from federal jurisdiction and charter to state. So there is so there's two answers to that question. There's the number of new, never been chartered before, and then there's the movement of people from state to federal, and that does kind of move. Sometimes you start at state, go to federal, come back to state. In the history of those financial institutions, Commissioner, yep. If you want to follow up,
you're
with
doing
all
a great job of advocating for our team's work. So thank you.
I appreciate the local control on that. What I don't appreciate, and I'm not making this a disparaging remark, is the overregulation that caused those folks to want to come back. To the point of Representative Binsbergen about, you know, wanting to make sure we have many options available. And I think that was embedded in Representative Ryer's question as well, that consumers have the confidence that these institutions are going to be there and that these institutions have the comfort level and the support that they're going to be able to do business so we can exist in that environment together. So with that, Commissioner, I'm going to have you go ahead and pick up on what's our slide 23, which begins the department's priorities through the governor's budget this year. And again, this is the governor's proposal. We'll have much more committee discussion time on this. Putting this into perspective, we have not seen the February forecast yet. We have not worked on house targets for financing for committees yet. We have not worked on, followed up on that with joint targets with the House and the Senate. So this is a proposal to kind of get the process started from what the department through the governor, or I should say from the governor through the department, are outlined as their needs for our consideration. And this same kind of conversation has happened, and if it hasn't, it will be happening in the Senate Commerce Committee as well. For those of you who are newer to this process, that's you know, kind of opening day, if you will, for getting the conversation started. So I'll shut up and I'll turn it back to Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair O'Driscoll. So this is an overview of the proposals that we have in the governor's budget. It's an operating increase, the premium security plan, otherwise known as reinsurance, the Petro Fund, the securities office staffing needs, Earned Wage Service Act. We can talk through that one. There's a policy attached to that. And then electric vehicle supply equipment testing is basically weights and measures for electric vehicles. And then we have a savings plan, which I'll talk through as well. So our operating increase, I appreciate that not everyone will agree with this. I would say it's fairly modest. It's $1.16 million in fiscal year 2026 and then $1.84 million in each subsequent year. So we've talked a lot about kind of growth in the industries. Our banking industry as an example, although it's the number of institutions has remained about the same, assets have grown by about 45% in the last 5 years. And that's one example of the kind of additional, kind of oversight that we're doing. We're not asking for additional FTEs except in a couple of areas, but we do have increased staffing costs. And then another part of that is IT costs. We're a department that has oversees quite a lot. We have a lot of sensitive company data, and we, at least as of 2 years ago, were the lowest state agency IT investment. Like, we had the lowest amount of IT investments. Representative Malcolms is getting excited about that. This is something that I think is really important. We have so this will help us to make sure that we have modern systems, that we're updating our systems, and that we are kind of maintaining an ease of working with the department, which has led to the transition of so many state banks into our system and other places. And so, you know, we really want to make sure that we have the systems in place to deal with that. I will say that we've taken some steps to identify costs. We've reduced our agency footprint. So when I started at the department, we were about 325 people. We're up to about 460 people. A lot of that growth is through federal funds in the energy area. But we have reduced our footprint in that time. So we've grown a lot and have less space for people. So that's saved us about $117,000 annually. And then we're in the process of renegotiating our lease. And so we'll consider how much we need, but the idea is that we would have a reduction in office space. We've also done some other things, like we reduced our leased office equipment. We've eliminated our TV contracts, which we had. And so we are working hard to make sure that we're reducing costs within the agency as we come forward with these requests. And so we can visit more in detail on any questions that folks have. Chair O'Driscoll mentioned that we would have a separate hearing on this, so I won't go too much into it. So the premium security plan, or the premium security account, is the name for the reinsurance program. That lowers premiums for about 187,000 Minnesotans who purchase insurance on the individual market. And it ensures that their consumers have meaningful choices. So we'll get into this when we have the hearing, but reinsurance is it's worked to reduce premiums in the market, but funding it has been a big challenge. Other states this proposal is much more akin to the way that other states fund their reinsurance programs. So whether it's North Dakota or Pennsylvania, they're using this type of mechanism to fund their programs. Without action to continue the premium security plan, the account will be depleted, and then individuals in the individual market are at risk of having premiums increased by 25% or more, which would mean that people will lose coverage. Fewer Minnesotans will receive primary care, and then they'll rely on expensive treatment like the emergency room.
Commissioner, I didn't ask you how you wanted to proceed with questions on this. I have one question right now, and I think it's probably specific to reinsurance. Do you mind if we just go slide by slide with questions on this? We have about 45 minutes left, or do you want to wait for those at the end? I don't want to interrupt your flow, which I just did. I understand. But.
Chair O'Driscoll, I'm happy to do questions one by one. That's totally
Representative fine. Davis.
Well, thank you very much. The reinsurance plan I carried back in, was it? I can't even think of what year it was.
18.
Was it 18? Okay, 2018. And it was probably the most successful program ever. It basically saved the individual market. I'm just reading this. It doesn't make any sense to me. So you're lowering premiums by 20%. But then you're charging the health plans $400 million or more. So my question is, if we're lowering it 20%, but we're charging back to the health plans, how much does that increase the premium?
Chair Driscoll and
Commissioner Arnold.
Representative Davids, I think there are more details of that, so I would maybe say we can get into that more during the hearing. But the one thing I'll point out is that there's the assessment is on a broader group than just the money that it's going to, so you kind of assess on a broader group, and then it goes into the pot to keep stability in the individual market, which benefits all the other markets. So it benefits the large group market, the small group market, and others.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and the Commissioner. That what I'd like to know, maybe, and not necessarily today, but I want to know, we're saying that we're lowering premiums on average 20%. How much are we raising premiums by charging another $597 million, or whatever that number is? That's got to be increasing premiums. So is it a 10% increase? Is it a 15% increase? Is it a 25% increase? Is it a 2% increase? Maybe your actuaries could contact me. I'd like to know, you were saying down by 20, but then is it up by 20? So we need those numbers. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Arnold.
Chair O'Driscoll, Representative Davids, I think probably worth a follow-up, but it's in the very low, it's like 1%, 2%.
Representative Davids, thank you for the 940 teaser that's in the television industry to try to keep people on for the 10 o'clock news. But you're setting the stage for our discussion next week on reinsurance. And I much appreciate that, sir.
Mr. Chairman, just make sure you stay tuned for next week.
Uh-huh. Another exciting episode of As Reinsurance Turns. Commissioner, back to you.
Sorry. I'm just imagining the casting of that. So. All right, Chair O'Driscoll, we can go to the Petro Fund. So this is IT and program support. This is the Petro Fund reimburses, as a reminder, a portion of the cost for cleaning up leaky storage premium petroleum storage tanks. The operations have not meaningfully increased in the last 2 decades, but we've had increased staffing costs, as you can imagine. And then we've had, you know, a lack of investment and an inability also to update some of our databases and IT systems. And so this would be an increase of $500,000 ongoing to cover salary costs that have increased over the last 20 years, and then make sure that we have space for new database construction. But I think almost as importantly, and I'm going to see Representative Elkins nod at this, maintaining the technology is just as important as funding it, because if you don't maintain it, then it doesn't work for anyone. And then other increased expenses related to inflation. All right, so let's talk about our securities program staffing needs. We have made significant progress in the technology improvements for our securities staff, but now we're kind of at the point where we have 2 examiners and 2 registration analysts, and they can't adequately support the large number of investment advisors and advisor representatives and broker-dealers that we have. One thing that we do when coming to you all to request additional funding is we look at other states to make sure that we're comparable. So we don't want to have, you know, a number of investment advisors that's examiners that's comparable to New York. They have a financial system that could be its own country, right? They're huge. That's not a good comparison. We look at states that have comparable number of registrants, comparable number of assets under evaluation, and then we look at where we are. So North Dakota has 2 examiners like we do. They have a tenth of the investment advisor advisors that we have, and I'll have to give you. So we're kind of like on par with North Dakota. The population is smaller. The number of investment advisors is smaller. This puts us more on par with a state like Tennessee. So this would have us have 6 advisors. And that's, we have kind of comparable numbers if you look at our market to Tennessee. So we kind of use that as a barometer. So we would propose to increase transfer fees and exempt reporting advisor fees. So it's not all licensing fees that would increase. This is a budget neutral item, but does have an impact on the, we would pay for this through fees. And then we would charge a nominal fee on narrowly focused activities that would allow the department to provide the additional resources. I will say when we look at the fees, we also look to make sure that we have fees that are comparable to other states. So in some cases, we don't have a fee currently where all the other states around us do. And so we would look at those places to make sure that there's kind of parity across, especially the upper Midwest.
Madam Commissioner, I have a question. On the securities, not specifically on the staffing, but in another portion of the governor's budget proposal to levy sales tax against services. Have you seen or have any information about how this affects this area that you regulate in the state of Minnesota?
Chair O'Driscoll, I don't, but we can follow up on that.
Thank you.
All right, so we'll move on to the Earned Wage Service Act. So this would be one FTE for licensing paid for by fees. In recent years, we've seen the arrival of sort of earned or early wage access and buy now, pay later products in the marketplace. So these products have begun to replace payday loans as a preferred short-term financing product that are often used by Minnesotans that are experiencing financial instability. So I heard yesterday that Target has one of these companies that they use for their likely like hourly wage workers if they need to get their paycheck a little bit earlier. They have high usage rates, but they're not consistently regulated. And so this is a revenue neutral proposal that would make sure that we have exam fees and licensing for this space. And then that will provide some consistency and make sure that we are able to take action when there are bad actors in this space. I should say on the securities proposal and this one, the investment FPA, Financial Professionals Association, is supportive of the securities proposal, and the Earned Wage Service Act, we have a number of companies that are supportive as well. In these cases, there is value in regulation because it sort of gives a stamp of consistency and stability and an ability to weed out bad actors. And so these are cases where we're seeing that when there isn't that ability to weed out bad actors, it hurts the entirety of the market. And so these are the places where we've kind of focused on making sure that we are doing that in a place that is needed and where there are potential bad actors.
Madam Commissioner, I do have a question here. I believe Representative Crescia has a question on this one. Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. I appreciate that information. I looked through the budget recommendation document that was put out by the governor. So in your testimony and what you said, is the department proposing at regulating these as a loan? Is that where the department is headed? And then my follow-up to that, Mr. Chair, would be why.
We'll take the first question.
Yep.
Commissioner Arnold.
Chair O'Driscoll, Representative Crescia. More like payday loan, so not in the way, but not as far as like having the usury rates and things like that. It's more in the licensing and exam of the company to make sure that the company is financially sound.
Representative Crescia, I wanted to break that into two because you might have had something different than the why part of that. So back to you, Representative Crescia.
Thank you. Yeah, I do have a couple of follow-up questions. So I'd be interested in why we're looking at a specific category here when this is really just a service. I mean, starting to lump it into the term of a payday loan seems a little bit premature. Is that for convenience or is there a specific regulation model that you would adopt?
Commissioner Arnold.
Yeah, Chair O'Driscoll and Representative Crescia, that was illustrative and not
exactly.
I think it's easier to explain that than to say. So we can get back to you about the specific details of what the regulation would look like. It's not the same as payday lending, but it is sort of an exam and license scheme. So we can visit more perhaps on the details and how it's the same and different as other types of regulation that we do, if that would be helpful.
Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, and I would recommend that we stay away from the comparisons because it's more of a services, and I understand where you're looking at the licensing side of it. And as you know, much history about the terms around here. So as I looked at the document and the governor's recommendation that was put out, the Consumer Financial Protections Bureau was referenced and the data coming from those. and other states. So my question would be, which state is the department looking at, or which state's modeling is the department looking at for possible adoption or guidance? Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Arnold.
Chair O'Driscoll and Representative Kershaw. I think, so we'll have to get back to you on some of these. I think it's probably worth visiting more so that you understand the whole scheme and kind of what we've been looking at. Happy to get back to you on that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kershaw.
If I could, Mr. Chair, I'm just going to push a little bit on that. You had mentioned North Dakota and other states and other areas. Is there any states here? I mean, just tell me which states you might be looking at.
Yeah.
Commissioner Arnold.
Chair O'Driscoll, Representative Kershaw. I don't know off the top of my head. So that's a me problem and not a
I understand. So, Mr. Chair. thank you. You are looking, if I could ask the commissioner, are you looking at other states and maybe you just don't know? Okay, so the answer is yes, you are. You just don't know specifically which ones those are. Would you like me to tell you? No, I'm kidding.
Commissioner Arnold.
Thank you.
I don't have anything to say.
Mr. Chair, no further questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kershaw. Representative Allen.
Thank you, Chair. Madam Commissioner, I appreciate you taking the time to be here with us and go through some of these issues. I was just in your testimony, you'd made a comment about the stability of payday loan institutions and whatnot. What's the metric you're using in order to establish stability of those kinds of groups?
Commissioner Arnold.
Chair O'Driscoll, Representative, I'm not sure what you're referencing. I think. Can you ask the question a different way?
Representative Allen, yeah, I kind of was wondering too. Just go ahead and rephrase. Take your time.
Yes. You were talking about within the institutions that you guys are you're planning on putting fees on or looking at doing these fees towards. Exactly. You were talking about their stability or something to that extent within those institutions. And I was kind of wondering what were you using to kind of.
Yeah, I think so. Chair O'Driscoll and Representative. So I think what I was intending to convey is that there is value in regulation in cases, in a lot of cases, not in all cases, but there's value in that the companies can be a part of an industry that is, you know, stable and is kind of has certain, I don't know if I don't want to say barriers to entry because that's not right, but it has certain requirements. So to be a part of that industry, you know that you're financially sound, you know that you're complying with Minnesota law. So that's what I was intending to convey with that, and just that there is value in having something that sort of gives that seal of approval, and it keeps the marketplace, whatever marketplace that is. It provides some stability to it, not in a financial safety and soundness way, but just in a kind of overall market dynamics way. Is that helpful?
Mm-hmm. Representative Allen, any follow-up?
No, thank you for that.
Thank you. I believe that's all the questions for here. We're on to electric vehicles, I believe. Oh, I'm sorry. I saw some heads turn over here. Okay. I want to make sure we get member questions. I think we're on to electric vehicles.
All right. As more Minnesotans are driving electric vehicles, we want to ensure that consumers get protected in the same way that they do at a gas station. So according to the U.S. Department of Energy, there are 2,276 charging ports across Minnesota. And so there is an effort by the electric vehicle supply equipment charger producers to develop uniform standards, but there's no regulatory oversight currently within Minnesota. We're proposing to authorize the weights and measures area to test and inspect. There would be a $100 charge per port collected from businesses to do an EV inspection. So I think this is I have an electric car. I have plugged it in at a charging station. I have come back, and it had like 10 miles of additional charge in my battery, and I was charged like $15-$20 for that. That wouldn't happen if you were filling up your gas car with gas. So you would know that your 2 gallons that you put in is going to get you as many miles as your car will go, and that you paid for those 2 gallons. We don't have that same scheme in the electric vehicle space, and so this would add that to that space. And I should say that there's NIST is I'm not going to get the acronym right, but is the national association that does kind of the testing standards for all of our weights and measures, and they have a specific chapter in their handbook that says how to do this. So we're not making it up. We're using federal or national standards, and we're kind of replicating what other states have done here.
Commissioner, before we move on, Representative Finke, I believe, has a question.
Thank you, Chair. Commissioner, of those 2,276 charging stations, how many are Tesla stations?
Representative Arnold. Chair O'Driscoll, Representative Finke, I don't know. I don't know if I can get you the answer, but we can get that, whether okay. we can get you the
Representative
answer.
Representative Finke?
Yep, follow up. You mentioned talking about standardizing, mm-hmm. right? And I would just be interested in hearing, you know, do we feel like that's coming? Is there a way to ensure that, you know, like when you told the story of the 10 miles for $15, I would be very interested in knowing if that was whose cars are on what charging stations and how those are being charged based upon these things. I know that's probably difficult data to access, but I think that that company needs to be extremely closely monitored, and I would like to have any information you have on it.
Commissioner Arnold, I want to just clarify, because part of that sounded to me like it might be from the Transportation Committee and those kinds of things where they will look at that. You're simply regulating whether the stations are doing what they're doing,
yeah.
just like the gas pumps regulate. Are they they're a proper amount of fuel and the like on that? So I just want to clarify that we may get a partial answer here, and another committee or jurisdiction may have the answer to what the standardization process might be. Just clarification.
Yeah, Chair O'Driscoll, thank you. You're helping me out on a bunch of these questions, so this is great. Mm-hmm.
I've been your phone a friend a couple times, so I'm happy to help.
So there's a distinction. So this is more about the charge and the electricity. So electricity goes into your car and you get charged. There are many other things about charging an electric vehicle, like do they have the same ports or not? Is it through a subscription or not? You know, like there are a lot of things kind of around that. This is just the electricity going in and the payment going out. And so, and I don't know how much of that your questions about who has which kinds will be able to get, but we can look at that.
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair. And the final follow-up. I appreciate that distinction, and I will ask over there as well, but I do think the nature of my question is that commerce interaction piece, right? It is, am I getting what I'm paying for at this charging station? And how am I, it's the same protection you compared it to the gas, right? You put the gas in, you get the gas. If you're putting in the plug and you're not getting the charge, that does feel to me like something in our purview here. So I just want to make sure I'm pursuing this forward. And not to mention the conflict of interest, which seems astronomical. So thank you.
Commissioner Arnold, any follow-up thoughts?
No.
Okay. Then back to you. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. We have Representative Dodseth and then Representative Krisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner, for being here today. Question I have is, what would the inspections look like on the electric supply equipment comparable to gas stations?
Commissioner Arnold.
Chair O'Driscoll, Representative Dodseth. Probably worth visiting in more detail with our team about it, but you can see how much current is going through, and you can kind of see when you plug in. So when I plug my car in, it tells me how fast it's charging. You would look at, you know, that and then compare it to what you're getting charged. So is that off? So is it saying that you're charging? Usually it's in kilowatts, so you're looking at, you know, how is the charge per kilowatt actually resulting in that many kilowatts going out of the charger. And then the actual charging function to make sure that that's lining up.
Representative Dodson, follow.
It does. I'm just trying to kind of compare apples to oranges for the comparable to gas versus.
You can think about it in a similar way, right? So, Chair O'Driscoll and Representative Dodseth. So you can think about it in a similar way, right? When we're testing a gallon of gas, we have something that is a gallon, right? You would have an independent kind of meter reader or whatever that will see how many kilowatts go out and will accept those kilowatts. So it's a battery probably with a little thing on it that says, okay, I'm up to this many kilowatts. And then you can test that against what the machine is saying and that the charge is the same. So, and there's a standard. We can send you the NIST handbook if you want. that all of this is so it's based on a standard that's a national standard that looks at how to measure electron flow through a wire, basically.
Thank you.
Representative Krusha, and then follow that will be Representative Elkins. Representative Krusha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, it's not lost on me. For 1999, you can go buy a voltmeter at Menards if you own your electric car. So I think that this could be done easier. But my real question is, as I'm laughing about this on the inside, is there a real perceived problem here, or is there a real problem we're solving, or is there a perceived problem that we've created that the department feels they need to regulate on this?
Commissioner Arnold.
Chair O'Driscoll and Representative Krusha, I will say I have personally had problems. Both Sam and I have electric cars. We have both personally had problems with charge and the battery output not working. That's anecdotal. There are apps where you can, where there will be, you can get feedback on that. And if you go through the apps, it's not uncommon to see this isn't putting out as much charge as it thinks it is. This one's just broken. Different problem. That would be in our purview. I'm happy to show you the app so you can see. But it's not a perceived. There's evidence that there are inconsistencies, and that evidence is through experience. We hear about it, but also. There's kind of a collection of complaints within these apps that are often the charging apps that you use to pay for it. Then people will comment, and so that serves as a little bit of a collection of real world experiences where this can be a challenge.
Representative Krusha,
and Mr. Chair, are these complaints of the dissatisfaction nature, or are they real problems? I mean, there's, I could be late for something, or I'm waiting, the gas isn't flowing fast enough, the electricity is not flowing fast. I mean, it sounds to me the anecdotal and the perceptions is sometimes I'm unhappy about this, so let's regulate it. Is that to the nature we are, Mr. Chair?
Chair of the school and Representative Krusha, I would say a good portion of our job is trying to separate exactly that question, because there are a lot of perceptions or feelings that something should or shouldn't happen. Whether or not that is true, whether or not that is in line with Minnesota law, and whether or not that's something that the department can take action on is something that we deal with every single day, right? And across all of our regulated industries, being late, like sometimes it's slower, sometimes it's not. It does advertise, like they are advertised as having a certain bandwidth, so there's a little bit of that might fit into the purview, but. Being charged for something different than you receive is sort of the fundamental thing that Weights and Measures does. And that is something that we all rely on. You rely on it when you buy turkey at the deli, right? That you're not paying for more, and that the store isn't giving you more than you're paying for. And so it's that same concept that's applied to, are you paying for what you're getting?
No further questions.
Different from the concept.
And to kind of put this a little bit, elevate the conversation a little bit and take a broader view on this. Charging stations, electric vehicles, I'm going to be generous. I've been around for a quarter of a century.
Yeah.
We've been pumping gas out of gas pumps for over a century and a half. That technology is probably a little bit more mastered and fine-tuned than the technology that we're looking at charging stations. It will come in time. With those kinds of things. I mean, that's just the evolution of the process. And I would be willing to bet, and I'm not going to spend a lot of committee time, but I bet the commissioner gets complaints in the office about the handheld gas pumps, as well as it's not just mutually exclusive to charging stations.
Chair O'Driscoll, that is correct. I will say the one asterisk I would put to the statement on the electric vehicles is that electricity has existed for a long time, and it's the same measurement. It's like the same principles of measurement. So the measurement part is something that is known and has been known for a long time. Yes, we get sometimes it's perception. Sometimes there's a perception that one gas station is always trying to short you, and then we go investigate whether or not that's real or not, and then we have the ability to say, okay, we have looked at this and it is real. That may not address all the perception problems, but it is at least addressing the facts problem to know whether it's the gallon, the right blend, etc.
With that, we're going to go to the last question on this slide. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it will probably not surprise too many members of this committee, but I have read not one but two standards body studies on this very topic, and I will dig out the links.
Representative Elkins, tell us more. I'm shocked.
The gist of it is that there is a wide variation in the degree of the accuracy of the meters in the cars measuring how much electricity is going into the car, so much variability that it would not be a reliable method of, say, measuring the electricity going into the car so that you could put a tax on it. But I will dig those out and send the links to Mr. Cotter for distribution to the department and to the committee members.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. With that, we're going to move on to your next slide, slide 30, state benchmarks. And it looks like we have four slides left in 20 minutes, so I think we're in pretty good shape.
All right. So this is a savings proposal that we've put forward. So this is the Affordable Care Act requires health plans that are sold on the individual and small group markets to cover a comprehensive set of benefits that are called essential health benefits. The specific items in the essential health benefits are determined through a process called benchmarking. And so that's where the scope of the benefits is determined. It doesn't determine the design, the cost sharing, anything like that. It's just what is covered. And it should be in alignment with a typical employee-based or employee-sponsored plan. So states are encouraged to periodically review and update the benchmark plan to ensure it reflects the current state of the insurance market and the medical care market. Whenever a state mandates a health benefit that's not covered by the EHB, then the state has to cover the increased premium costs through defrayal payment. Our benchmark plan was last updated in 2023, and so we plan to create a new benchmark plan that is based on CGIP as sort of the starting point, and then there's a process for public comment, and there's like a process to go through and review it. And we would be submitting it to CMS in May. The updated benchmark would go into effect in January 2027, and we would anticipate that the benefits would include some mandates that currently require defrayal, including PANS and PANDAS, rapid whole genome sequencing, some orthotic and prosthetic devices, and biomarker testing. So that'll reduce the state deferral payments by $3.9 or almost $4 million in fiscal year 2028, and then the savings go on from there.
This last updated in 2013, not
2023. Oh, did I say 2023? Oh, gosh. No, 2013. It's been over 10 years. Thank you.
So that concludes our discussion on fiscal budget issues, and now to our policy issues.
Great. All right. We have so these are our policy items. So we have a consumer protection and transparency proposal, which would clarify consumer rights, including rights to policy review and appraisal and other areas in the property car insurance space, cost-sharing standards for homeowners insurance appraisals, mortgage service servicing conduct and consumer protections, and then new standards for people who sell securities under a federal exemption called regulation crowdfunding. The next policy bill was an insurance policy bill, so this would authorize Minnesota to offer car insurance to people who cannot obtain insurance through the Minnesota Automobile Insurance Plan, so this is sort of the provider of last resort. It would also make some technical changes about the way that coverage is written, so currently we have to go through an intermediary. This would allow the proposal to be directly written by the Auto Insurance Plan Service Office. It would adopt NAIC standards on, so NAIC is the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. They often will do standards that are that can be adopted by states. In some cases, those standards are sort of optional and provide consistency in the marketplace. And in some cases, those standards are required for us to be able to be accredited. So we have one proposal here that's in the optional bucket and is a standardization thing that's good for the long-term care insurance industry. And then the other one is some changes to the way that the state law works around when there are groups of insurers that are under a conglomerate to make sure that that is consistently reviewed across the country. So if we have one part of an insurance conglomerate and other states have others, that we're making sure that we have the ability to test the financial stability of the entire conglomerate, but also to make sure that there's consistency across the states in reviewing the portions of that group, and you're not reviewing one part of the group in one way and one part of the group in the other way, and then you miss some part of the stability of the overall company. And then we have a technical bill. Oh, so the final part in the insurance policy bill is to add some authority for insurance-related data calls without using our enforcement process. So we'd like to be able to collect data outside of an enforcement process. Enforcement processes are enforcement, and so they have their own flavor to them. Collecting some data outside of that process would be very helpful to understanding our market, as we know that the property and casualty insurance market is challenging now. And then we have a technical bill to reduce administrative burdens and compliance barriers in the student loan borrower bill of rights, and some other changes that are technical in nature. Okay, so I talked to you. Oh, sorry, I did this in the wrong order. So our group capital calculation is the one I was mentioning just before. So this is, we need to adopt this in order to maintain our accreditation in advance of January 2026. And it, again, is kind of an update to the way that we look at entire groups of individual insurance companies. We have a health policy bill, which would require all Medicare supplemental plans to offer an open enrollment plan variant with identical benefits and cost sharing as the existing plan variant. We also have a requirement, a proposal to require the Commerce and chairs to consider available funding and evaluation costs when we're identifying new mandate reviews. So as you know, there's a process if you'd like to add an insurance mandate to the health insurance market. There's a whole process to evaluate what that would cost. We have run up against constraints within our staff to be able to handle the volume of mandate requests that have come in. And so we'd like to make sure that the number of evaluations we do is in line with the budget that we have. And then we would align Minnesota's guarantee renewability law with federal standards. This is on the health side, to allow for plan terminations when there are very few enrollees. This is a reducing burden on companies without sacrificing consumer protections. There are some plans that have very few enrollees. They'll have like four people on the plan, and people just keep renewing it. But they have to maintain the plan for a long period of time, and we don't have an ability to allow them to allow the plan to put the people into similar coverage or the same coverage, but on a different product, and then they're having to maintain that product. And then there's a mortgage index and usury modernization. There is an old Fannie Mae index rate for second lien mortgages that is referred to in state statute that doesn't exist anymore. Fannie stopped publishing it. So we would replace that one with the average prime offer rate that's published by the Consumer Protection, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And that concludes my presentation.
Commissioner, I just have a couple of quick questions on the policy changes. Mm-hmm. We know we're going to be talking reinsurance at some point. We've got questions with rising costs of insurance and healthcare. What kind of an impact will this have in premiums with these new policies that we're looking at for companies when they have to build in their costs and they come to you for rate approval? Have you sat down to visit with the industry to see if they're open to any of these provisions, or which ones are their input to try to help contain costs in the enforcement and the regulations and the policy changes that you're looking at here?
Yeah, sure, Chair Driscoll. I think, so if we're looking at just the health insurance ones, which I think is the question that you have, so the guaranteed renewability law changes should decrease costs for the carriers. Whether that shows up in premium, I don't know how much cost. I don't know how much it's costing them currently to maintain, but that would decrease cost. The mandate is more a state budget thing than anything else, and then the Medicare supplemental plans are that proposal is a proposal that is in part dealing with a change to law that will happen in 2026, and it will help to moderate to make sure that there are consumer protections while hopefully moderating some expected cost increases in the Med Sub market that are result of a law that will come into effect in 2026.
And the reason I raise that question is I've been around here long enough to have been in front of committees when a bill author is bringing something forward and saying, certainly the department can absorb this, and the department comes back and says, it's a hard cost for us, and it's going to be this equivalency in FTE, or we need these dollars. I suspect that that's equally the case when there's just a simple provision that the agency wants, that the private sector is going to be asked to pick up, that there's a cost to it. And I want to be respectful on both sides when we hear it from the agencies, when there's a written inquiry, and when the agency is asking for a policy change that can have a financial impact on the party that they're regulating in this particular, you know, set of policies that you're looking at.
Yeah, Chair Driscoll, and we visited with the plans on all of these, so we can, as we have ongoing conversations about each of these, we can kind of, they're each a little different, but we can have that conversation for sure.
I guess for the record, and I'm not impugning anyone with that, it's just an observation over the years that physics is alive and well here. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction to comments and to events. With that, Representative Chai, I know you have a question. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Chair. This is regarding car insurance in the state of Minnesota. Is the credit rating used to determine car insurance rates in the state of Minnesota?
Chair Driscoll, Representative Cha, that would be a company by company thing. There's no blanket requirement or prohibition against using credit rating.
Representative Cha, follow up?
No, thank you, Chair.
All right. Representative Dotseth and then Representative Elkins.
Just a quick question, Madam Commissioner. What do you expect the premiums for health care will increase with the updated benchmarks on the plan that you proposed?
Commissioner Arnold.
Chair Driscoll and Representative Dotseth, minimal impact. We can get back to you with specific numbers if we have them.
Representative Dotseth, please go through the chair. Thank you.
When you say minimal, what would you expect minimal to look like?
Chair Driscoll and Representative Dotseth, I will do some quick math on the fly. It's $3 million over 187,000 people whose average premium is about $300 a month. So, like, fairly minimal.
Representative Dotseth.
Like, really, really minimal, not like minimal, oh, it's $10 or $15 is like way less than that. But I don't have that. I can't do that math that fast.
Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when we come back to discuss reinsurance, one of the things that I would hope would be in the, like to see in the package that members receive is that there is a report, a reinsurance program report that breaks down the reinsurance payments by, you know, what was the condition that was being treated that generated. And looking at that report in the past, you could see that, you know, all of the top ones are manageable chronic conditions for the most part. And I would like to have that report included in the materials when we come back to that subject, because I think it will help inform the discussion we're going to have.
Representative Elkins, thank you for that comment. Two thoughts. We have a couple of different ideas floating around about reinsurance.
Yep.
One that you're working on that was referencing the Homeowners Association stuff that Representative Hewitt talked about.
That's different.
That is not what we're bringing up at this point. We're talking strictly about the health insurance reinsurance program. And I respect and understand why you want that and working toward eliminating those factors or helping people to manage those factors. My concern is it's not just that group. It's system-wide, whether you're in a commercial plan or an ERISA plan. I think we get a better idea of what's going on. I don't like the idea of singling out one group and saying, what should that group do of the persons who are covered in the self-insured market? I think it's more global. That's just my reaction. Representative Elkins.
No, I don't disagree with you that. I mean, it is a broader question. The reason I'd like to discuss it in this context is that the last time reinsurance came up, Chair Emeritus Stevenson went out to us all and said, look, do you have ideas for improving the program? And I came up with a proposal that would have given more generous attachment points that had better quality ratings to plans that had better quality ratings for measuring, managing those kinds of conditions. And it's an idea that I might want to bring back to this committee.
You're certainly welcome to do so, sir. With that, there are no other questions. I guess at this point, it's lead, soon to be co-chair again. Her, anything from your perspective for this morning, for the good of the cause? All right. Tomorrow, we will once again have the commissioner back. But before we talk about tomorrow, thank you. You've been taking questions nonstop and presenting for well over an hour and a half. Well done. Appreciate the information. Members, thank you for your questions today. We will be adjourned until tomorrow morning, which we will be talking about. And commissioner will be back with Superintendent Drew Evans from the BCA to discuss the moving of the fraud investigators from the Department of Commerce, the regulator, to the new enforcement division that was created by an executive order. With that, we are adjourned.